Welcome to the Space Show, Heather.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's great to be on.
What got you interested in astronomy?
My dad was an airline pilot, and when I was about 8 or 7 or 6, I can't remember, I was looking out of the window and looking at planes in the sky stacking over Heathrow Airport in London, where I lived, and I suddenly saw a green shooting star. And I was totally amazed. And I rushed into my parents. My dad was there at the time. Must have been 11 o'clock in the evening, far too late for me to be up. "Mummy, Daddy," I said, "I'd seen a green shooting star." And they said, "That's nice, dear, but there's no such thing as a green shooting star." And in the paper the next day it said, "Green shooting star seen over West London." And that was it. I was just hooked onto astronomy.
So where did you go from then? You went through university, presumably.
Oh, no, it was much more complicated.
Right.
I gave up astronomy when I was 13, when I got into boys, rock bands and makeup and all the usual stuff. I went into fashion retailing as a management trainee and working in London at Topshop, which was really cool. And then it wasn't until about 3 years later, 2 years later when I was 20, that I suddenly thought, hey, this is crazy. I would much rather be doing something sensible rather than doing something frivolous. And I went to the library and got a book on astronomy, and I realised the whole subject had changed from when I was a very, very small girl to when I was a teenager, and things like black holes and supernovae and space had all happened, and I thought, I really want to be in this area. And so I gave up my job in London. I went to Cambridge to work as a very lowly assistant for the Cambridge Observatories, and I did an extra A-level, which is the qualifying exam to get into university, that gave me 3 A-levels. I then only had 2. And I struggled into university to do a degree in astrophysics.
Which university
Leicester,
did you go to?
Leicester, right in the middle of one of the best space universities in the world. They're the guys who run the whole programme of X-ray astronomy satellites. And I'm delighted to say that as one of the 9 Millennium Commissioners in Britain who've given out £2.1 billion sterling in money to new projects to celebrate the millennium, one of our millennium projects is the National Space Science Centre at Leicester, where people will be able to have hands-on experience of what it's like to fly the space shuttle and that kind of thing. That was one of our projects. So I'd given some money back to my old university.
Okay, so you would have gone right through the Uhuru days then, and the Einstein Observatory and that sort of thing?
That's right, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I do remember Uhuru, which was when I was an extremely very, very young undergraduate, and it excited me an awful lot. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to go to Leicester, because they were sort of really sort of at the forefront of new ways of doing research, and they were looking at what Patrick Moore in those days used to call invisible astronomy. And I thought, well, this is just the way of the future, because we're just, you know, limiting ourselves to radiations like light. I'd like to actually look at the whole spectrum from gamma rays right the way through X-rays and ultraviolet light, infrared, to radio waves, which is telling us new science about the universe.
So you'd be very excited then by the Chandra X-ray Observatory and by XMM Newton.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm very excited by all that sort of stuff, and I'm afraid it takes a lot of time to prise me away from all those cool websites. I'm looking at this all the time on my computer.
Okay, so what moved you on then from astronomy, you know, hands-on as it were, into filmmaking?
I got very bored with doing research. When I finished at Leicester, I went to Oxford to do my PhD, to do research, because I realised the only way to be a professional astronomer was actually to go and be a specialist in one area. And what I hadn't realised, when you're an undergraduate, you cherry-pick at all the subject, and it's a fabulous subject. You can, one day you're studying Jupiter's atmosphere, the next day you're studying the centre of the sun, day after that you're looking at meteors, the day after that you're studying clusters of galaxies. And I actually figured that I wouldn't mind studying clusters of galaxies for my PhD thesis. But unfortunately, you have to become such an expert in such a small area. And I remember going to the library at Oxford and picking up things like the Astrophysical Journal and the Astronomical Journal and things like that. And every day thinking, oh my goodness, this guy's got this new paper published and I've got to be up to speed with what they're thinking about. And I thought, this is crazy, devoting the whole of my life to one small area of astronomy, even though it might have been a big region of astronomy. And I got bored. And in the end, I got drunk at a party in Cambridge, fell upstairs at a Cambridge college on a stone staircase, broke my right arm, couldn't write up my thesis, and waved 2 fingers and left astronomy altogether. And that's when I went and joined my friends in Cambridge and thought of, what am I going to do? And one of my friends in London said, Heather, you're quite a good writer. I've seen some of your stuff. Can you write for the general public? And I said, well, I'll have a try. And I ended up writing for a popular magazine called How It Works, which grew into an encyclopedia in 98 weekly parts. And then that led to more writing. I ended up writing my first book. And so I gradually got into communications. And then I figured the way to get on was to move to London. And I moved to London and I took up the job. I was lucky enough to get the job of the head of the planetarium at Greenwich, which is a very small planetarium, only seats about sort of 50. It's not like Melbourne's planetarium or Brisbane's planetarium. It's a tiny one. It's basically for kids, basically. And I gave lectures to the general public for about 5 years. And in the meantime, my colleague, Nigel Henbest, who I had been working with and writing books with since I was extremely tiny, he had one consultancy for every day of the week, and I was still talking to eight-year-olds, and I figured he was doing something right and I was doing something wrong. So I left the planetarium, where I was doing more and more media work, but the planetarium wouldn't let me do media work because they were a bit funny about it. And the next thing I knew is I was elected the president of the British Astronomical Association, which was major. I mean, the BAA was then 96 years old. They had never had a female president. They had never had such a young president. And the media just beat a path to my door. I mean, literally, physically, one of the Daily Telegraph reporters I found sitting on my doorstep one day when I did not want him to be around. And I golfed down the wine bar. And then the next thing I knew is that I was invited to do a TV series on British television called The Planets. Not the recent Planets, but a very old Planets series. And I said to my colleagues, who are all male, I said, look, this is really unfair on you guys, because it's only because I'm female that they're trying to get me to do these things. And they said, look, don't knock it, because, you see, what you can do, Heather, is you are a great showcase for science. You know, if they asked us to do it, we'd be doing what you're doing. But, you know, please speak publicly about science and, you know, forget the fact that they find you very attractive and all that kind of thing. And so I just became a sort of public open mouth for science, did my first TV series, and I've really never looked back. And after that, I did another series called The Stars. And then after that, the director of that series said, look, we're doing that series for an independent production company called The Moving Picture Company. And he said, why are we doing this for somebody else when we could actually be producing it ourselves? So 10 years ago, I formed, with Stuart and Nigel, Pioneer Productions, which has gone on to be probably the biggest science and factual production company in the world. It's worth several million pounds. It now employs 70 employees. It has a huge office block in London, which it owns. And I've just left the company because it became too big for its own boots. And we're doing huge co-productions with the Americans because our computer graphics sequences need lots of money. And the only way you can fund that is to have American money on board. But American co-produced programs have no presenters. Even David Attenborough is written out of his own programs in America because the Americans just don't like the British on camera. And so I've left the company to go freelance again and to present my own programmes. So it's a scary time, but I've got to do it.
Right, okay. Have you found like the difference between making The Planets and making, say, the recent one, Universe? How has the new technologies made a difference in your filmmaking?
Oh, the new technology has made an enormous difference to filmmaking. I mean, the computer graphics has just been absolutely formidable. We hardly used any... The only computer graphics we used on The Planets would have been NASA-generated computer graphics, which was nice, a bit clinical, whereas the stuff we used on Universe was, you know, state-of-the-art computer-generated stuff. In fact, I would actually say to you that we actually worked out the budgets for the four programs by saying, okay, how much are the animation sequences going to cost? And then we costed in the trips to America around the budget for the graphics. And the reason being, if you're making programs for commercial television, you have the commercial breaks in the middle, and people are expecting the computer graphics on the series to be as good as the stuff you see on the commercial breaks. And if it's not as good, they'll just turn to another channel. So it's, you know, we actually cost the programs by how much our, you know, our animation sequences are going to cost.
Right. So to some extent, the commercials, you know, the quality of them, drives the production values on a TV program.
Exactly. It is. You are driven these days by animation because young people expect to see cool animation, really classy animation. So that's how we're driven. You're absolutely right.
And do you have to make compromises in the scientific content of that when you're making them?
We don't make any compromise on the scientific content at all. We make sure... The only compromise I'd say we'd make is we don't actually interview scientists who are dry and boring. They might be great scientists, but we will not interview anybody who either A, looks boring, or B, says boring things. We do select our scientists for their accessibility. So, you know, if anybody's going out there, wants to be a scientist, wants to be famous, I'd say polish up your communication skills as quickly as possible, because that's what's so important. That's what drives television today.
So do you decide ahead of time who you're going to interview, or do you just let it flow as you're doing the production? In other words, is what a scientist says on camera almost scripted?
It's what a scientist said on camera is not so much scripted as it is well researched in advance. Now, the way that the Americans make television programs is they just go there and shoot from the hip. What we do is to do research beforehand. So we'll go out to wherever and do a recce. Now, we wanted to come to Australia to make this program as well, but unfortunately we didn't get any funding from the Australians, so I'm afraid Australia had to go. We wanted to go to Antarctica as well, because there's so much great science coming out of Antarctica, especially involved with astronomy. And again, that had to go. We didn't have the budget. But we did do a recce of both people and what they were saying. So in a sense, what happens is, yes, things are, to an extent, scripted beforehand, because we've met guys like, say, Larry Krauss or the Astronomer Royal, Martin Rees, and we know what they have to say. So the people who are the broadcasters, like Channel 4 in Britain or Discovery in the States, need to see the kind of flow of the script of the programme before they approve the funding in entirety. So they are commissioning that. So, you know, we will say, Martin Rees is going to say something like this. And so my skill as an interviewer is to say to Martin, I want you to say this, and he'll say it.
To what extent does the public expect some sort of fantasy, just entertainment, uncritical of scientific values or accuracy, compared to those who prefer documentaries?
We are actually rigorous documentary filmmakers. We don't have any fantasy at all. I mean, I'm actually, it's a terrible thing to say, I'm actually not a fan of science fiction at all. When I have my relaxation at home in the evenings, I will read a book on the English countryside or history or architecture, because I'm fascinated by those things rather than science fiction. I think science fact has got so many things going for it that I would rather just get the facts across in a glorious way. So I like to present science in the way that you'd look over a beautiful landscape and think, gosh, isn't that beautiful? And it says it for itself without having to elaborate.
To what extent do you find many of the scenes, for example, our quantum program, I don't know if you've seen it.
I have, yes.
The opening logos, the opening scenes are all alienating to some extent. They're not really warm and human.
I mean, I don't like that kind of thing at all. I mean, one of the strands that we make programs for in England is a Channel 4 series called Equinox. And it's deliberately, the opening sequence is deliberately contrived to make you feel that you're looking at a robot. And I hate that image of science. I really, really think it's alienating. And in fact, you know, today we've been looking at film clips from various films. And I have to say how incredibly clinical a lot of the science fiction films are. And I think that is something that turns a lot of young people off science. It turns a lot of young people onto science because they think, wow, that's cool, that looks sort of absolutely sanitized and clean and everything. But, I mean, science is a much more warmer, more cuddly world than it's actually purported to be. And I think an awful lot of programmes like Quantum, like Equinox, make the mistake by having the upfront graphics looking very, very sort of, alien and robotic.
What sort of projects are you working on now?
Well, having left Pioneer Productions only a year ago and having done Universe, I've decided I'm going freelance again. I'm going to be a presenter. I love presenting. And the one thing I think, being a presenter and having a presenter on show, is that it brings a warmth to science that you don't get by just having a voiceover. Like, in fact, in the case of Universe, we had John Hurt, the Hollywood movie star. that was because Discovery Channel insisted on it. So the I've been doing a lot of radio projects recently. I presented a huge series for the BBC World Service about 4 months ago called The Essential Guide to the 21st Century. And that was a 40-part series aired all over the world to about 200 million people, which looked at where we're going in the 21st century. And it was stranded into 8 weeks of 5 programmes each. So we had drama, we had sport, we had the arts. But my job was to host the programmes on science. So I was going across to America and interviewing all these scientists from different disciplines. So it would be biology, I'd be talking about genetic modification, or the latest stuff in computers, like wearable computers with virtual screens in front of your faces, or the brain, or space, or cosmology. And because science is so popular, I got to present the first 5 programmes. So I presented those, and that was very successful. The latest project I'm actually just starting to work on when I get back home is a best-selling book, as I hope it will be, because Universe was a best-selling book. The successor is a book all about Mars, because there are lots of missions going to Mars over the next 10 years, and there are 2 Hollywood movies coming out in the next year. So we're sort of kind of sort of dovetail on that and go across to the States in the summer and interview all the key scientists who are doing amazing things about, has there been life on Mars? Will we drill down into the soil on Mars to find Martian samples? When will people go to Mars? Will we change Mars into a world like the Earth? So that's the next big project. And I'm hoping out of that I'll get a TV series as well.
Have you seen the recent film Mission to Mars?
I have not seen Mission to Mars, but I've saw a clip of it today, and it looked pretty good, and I'd love to see it. And there is another one coming out in a few months' time. It's funny, isn't it, how you get these programmes coming out or films coming out with the same theme, because we had the great Armageddon, we had all these, you know, impacts by meteor stuff a couple of years ago. It's Mars at the moment. I can't predict. I mean, I think people are projecting it's going to be genetic modification in 2 years' time.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us tonight on The Space Show, Heather.
I've very much enjoyed it. It's been absolutely great, and more power to your elbow.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for joining us.
Cheers.